May it please the Court, David Christian on behalf of Columbia Casualty Company. May I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Sure.
Thank you. Your Honors, Congress enacted a statute governing the standing of parties in interest in Chapter 11 cases at 11 U.S.C. Section 1109B. That statute provides for broad participation in bankruptcy proceedings and has been recognized by this Court and other courts as granting standing at the bankruptcy court level to anyone who has a legally protected interest that could be affected by a bankruptcy proceeding. Notwithstanding that statute and notwithstanding the precedence from this Court and the James
Wilson... I don't understand dragging all these people into settlement negotiations. I don't understand that.
Well, Your Honor, that's...
I mean, suppose you were injured in an automobile accident and you sue... And you're having some litigation with the driver. Suppose you owe me money. And I say to myself, you know, if he doesn't go for broke and get a really big judgment, now that he's injured and he can't work and so on, he's not going to pay me back. So I want to be in that settlement negotiation because I have a stake. I don't want him to settle. I want him to go for broke. The settlement isn't going to do me any good. Now, wouldn't that be ridiculous?
Well, Judge Posner, I think...
Any time there's a litigation, there are bound to be others who have some sort of stake in that litigation because of their relations, their financial relations with one of the parties.
Two points in response to that, Judge Posner. First of all, Chapter 11 proceedings are by their nature collective proceedings with multiple seats around the table that aren't necessarily plaintiff against defendant in every dispute. There are other parties in interest, and Congress recognized that and provided for broad participation in Chapter 11 proceedings by enacting Section 1109B. The second response I have to you, Your Honor, is that this case is not the hypothetical that you described. Here we're talking about a mass injury Chapter 11 case, which of necessity will involve many players. And as the courts have recognized, insurance is sometimes not only an important asset, it's sometimes the only significant asset.
Well, you could have, your client, of course, could have protected itself as a secondary insurer by its contract with its insured, right? Say the insured. I don't want you to think that because we're your secondary insurer, you can ignore your primary insurer. So we want to be in on that. Any negotiations you have with the primary insurer, you have that. You can protect yourself contractually, but the notion that anybody with a financial interest in the outcome of a settlement can be a party to the settlement—that's that's kind of astonishing.
Well, I think, Your Honor, there's a difference between being a party to the settlement and having your right granted by, both by statute and by the bankruptcy rules to appear and be heard on the subject recognized by the bankruptcy court. And it's an important...
Yeah, well, you're going to be arguing the settlement is inadequate. You're going to say, well, they didn't...
Or Your Honor...
They didn't fight hard enough, right? They should have fought harder. So let's have a new proceeding in which I'll be the principal.
Or, Your Honor, that we advocate for changes to either the settlement or provisions in a settlement approval order that protect our legitimate interests.
Forgive me, but Judge Goldgar said that even if your client did have standing, the objections it was raising were not relevant to his decision whether or not to approve the settlement. And on that basis, it seems he overruled those objections. But you haven't challenged that aspect of his ruling in the brief. So why aren't any arguments to his approval of the settlement waived, assuming Columbia does have standing?
Your Honor, because all of this occurred at the preliminary hearing on the motion. The motion was noticed up for a preliminary hearing. We showed up at the bankruptcy court to object, and Judge Goldgar told us from the get-go that he determined that we did not have standing and that he would therefore approve the motion because there were no other objections. Had we been granted party and interest standing, as the statute called for, we could have done discovery, we could have cross-examined
witnesses. Well, that's precisely the problem. You're going to do discovery, you're going to cross-examine the parties about what they talked about in the settlement?
Well, not necessarily that, Your Honor.
Why didn't you press harder and this and that? That's good. That's unmanageable.
Let's look at it from another perspective, Judge Posner.
Just tell me, this discovery, what is it you're going to be looking for in discovery?
Well, let me tell you some of the things that
we
do know.
No, you answer my question. What are you going to be looking for in discovery?
There are very suspicious circumstances that gave rise to this settlement, Your Honor. I don't know all of the facts because we were not granted that opportunity, but let me tell you what we do know. We know that in June of 2009, the so-called Cooney claimants, approximately 505 of them, entered into a settlement with the debtor. We know that in June of 2009, the same month, those parties entered into a purported security agreement to secure their right to insurance proceeds, or allegedly secure their right to insurance proceeds. We know that the same month, June of 2009, those claimants went to the Cook County Circuit Court and somehow got a judgment against the debtor, even though there had been no summons served and no responsive pleading filed of any kind by the debtor. So all of this happens in the space of the month.
So what are you saying? Is it fraud here?
Well, if you look at the face...
Well, are you saying there's fraud?
There may be.
Are you saying there's fraud?
Your Honor, I can't...
Are you saying that you're looking for evidence of fraud?
Correct, Your Honor.
Well, if there's a fraud, you can bring a fraud case.
But not if those claims have been adjudicated and then a settlement involving those claims or some aspect of those claims has been approved by a final order of the bankruptcy
court. Why not? If there's fraud?
Well, one way...
Fraud on the bankruptcy court?
It's one thing to say there was a fraud that was then resolved. There's another thing to say there was a fraud in the presentation to the bankruptcy court. We're not saying the latter. We're saying there are suspicious circumstances involving the claims.
Okay, so you're saying what? That the other insurance company committed fraud? Or the debtor committed fraud?
Well,
someone committed fraud, or both of them committed fraud?
The other insurance company, Judge Posner, is in a receivership proceeding.
They tried to defraud you, your client.
We have
tried to defraud your client.
We have two problems, Your Honor. And maybe I can illustrate it with one of the facts that we know. If you look at the face of
Wait a second. You think that your client was a victim of fraud by the primary insurer and by the debtor, right?
Not exactly, Your Honor. Let me describe our view of what we know. We know that if you look at the face of the complaint that led to the judgment in the same month, June of 2009, on the eve of the bankruptcy filing, that some of the names are duplicates. They're the same people, right? So there may have been a lack of care. It's possible it was fraud. It's possible that it was an effort to get the number as big as possible. It's possible it was a mistake. There are suspicious circumstances. And at a minimum, even if it's a mistake, we need to protect ourselves from potentially being asked to indemnify for that mistake. And we had to do that at the time of the settlement approval hearing, or else be told that an order was entered that either explicitly or implicitly validated these claims. That's why we're here today. Now, there are other remedies for the complaints we were making. It's not necessarily we get to be a party to the settlement and sit at the negotiating table. It's possible for the order approving the settlement to have provisions that say this isn't a determination of the merits of the claims that were used to give rise to the claim in the integrity receivership estate, or that notwithstanding this order, the rights of Columbia Casualty Company to make all the kinds of coverage arguments or raise other defenses like fraud that Your Honor described remain available to it. But without standing to appear and be heard about those concerns, we don't have the ability to advocate for those kinds of protections in the order. So there are many ways to either mitigate or eliminate the potential harm to our client, but without standing, we don't have the ability to appear and be heard on that. And that's why both Section 1109B and the bankruptcy rules call for notice.
Of course, you would have wanted to be able to intervene before the settlement, right?
Well, I guess...
You wouldn't want them negotiating the settlement in your absence.
Judge Posner, a couple of responses to that. First of all, obviously, we'd like there to be more money rather than less come into the estate to pay the claims that we might also be asked to indemnify. So to the extent that our participation can help get that number up and put pressure for a bigger number from another party, obviously we're in favor of that. But that doesn't mean that's the only thing that would either mitigate or eliminate our objections. If we're told, for example, that the claims that were used...
But didn't you want to intervene before the settlement?
Well, I'm not sure we knew about it until the motion was filed and we received notice of it.
Well, suppose you knew about it.
Your Honor, if nobody is asking us to indemnify the claims that were used to settle with the Integrity Estate in New Jersey, then we don't care. The problem here is they're going to ask us to indemnify the same claims. And so to the extent
that they... you know there's a primary insurer, and you're the secondary insurer. So aren't you worried from the beginning of the bankruptcy that maybe the primary insurer won't pay or won't pay enough? So wouldn't you want to be in at the very beginning?
Your Honor,
in fact, if you weren't in at the very beginning, the judge might say, well, it's too late.
Your Honor, we had previously issued a reservation of rights letter, and we'd also filed a declaratory judgment action in Cook County Circuit Court because we believed we don't have a coverage obligation for these claims. Now, it also came to pass that there was a Chapter 11 case and this settlement with the Integrity Estate that potentially impacted us, and so we needed to act to protect our rights in addition to what we'd already done. But our first avenue of attack was the declaratory judgment action. To adjudicate our rights and responsibilities vis-a-vis the debtor and its estate. That remains pending, and I guess what I'm saying is...
But when did you learn that the primary insurer was negotiating with the debtor?
This happened in a series of transactions. So first of all, just for context, the insured, the future debtor, had commuted a bunch of other policies in past years. At the time of the bankruptcy filing, what was left is our excess policy and a claim against the Integrity Receivership Estate in New Jersey. Now, they had previously done a partial settlement with the Integrity Estate that had brought some money to the insured, but there was a final bar date facing the estate or the debtor in the New Jersey receivership proceeding involving Integrity. So there was this series of transactions whereby the debtor was attempting to
get cash. I asked a very simple question. When did you or your client discover that there was a claim against the Integrity primary insurer and that the parties were negotiating over the claim?
We knew of the existence of a claim against Integrity for years. We were aware that there was a bar date coming up in the Integrity Receivership Estate. We only learned of the settlement that's the subject of this appeal when a motion for approval of that settlement was filed with the Bankruptcy Court and served on us.
You didn't know they were negotiating for a settlement?
We did not know they were negotiating for this particular settlement until we received
the motion. Not this particular settlement.
We knew they had a claim, and we knew there were disputes with the
and
Integrity Estate.
And it could affect you as the secondary, your client as a secondary insurer.
Potentially, yes. Right. And so, for that and other reasons, we filed a declaratory judgment action, which, as I say, remains pending. I see my light is on. I want to make sure I reserve time
for
rebuttal.
Yeah, okay, that's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christian. Mr. Tobin?
Good morning, Your Honors. Stephen Tobin on behalf of Joseph Baldy, the Chapter 7 trustee of the C.P. Hall Estate. May it please the Court. There are two ways that Columbia could become entitled to standing to object to a settlement in a bankruptcy case. One, if they're a creditor of the estate. They are not a creditor of the estate. They have no interest in the proceeds of the estate. Two, Your Honor raised this during argument by counsel, if they had a contractual provision that gave them some kind of veto right over a settlement with the primary insurer, they have no such contractual provision. So therefore, under this court's, I think, fairly well-settled case law for the last 20 years, they don't have a pecuniary interest or a legally protectable interest that the bankruptcy court saw fit to protect.
But Columbia's not like a Chapter 7 debtor who has no personal stake in the settlement at all. I mean, one can see how Columbia's potential exposure on the excess insurance policy indeed might be affected by the settlement with Integrity. So why shouldn't Columbia's objection at the very least be heard?
Well, it was heard, as Your Honor pointed out. It was heard. And what they focused on was the harm to Columbia for a settlement with the receiver of the Integrity Insurance Company. So they were looking down the wrong end of the telescope. The issue in a settlement before a bankruptcy court is whether or not it's in the best interest of the estate. So the debtor in possession at that time was the debtor in possession, not the trustee. The debtor in possession had very experienced and able insurance counsel, Mr. Hoke, who had secured, I believe, a total of over $30 million from the Integrity Estate, secured more money from the Integrity Estate than any other lawyer in the United States. And he had a $10 million...
In the history of the United States?
No, in any lawyer... No, I'm sorry. I meant to say in any lawyer other in the United States with respect to the Integrity case.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's a pretty big case.
I want his name and number.
Yeah. Well, the Integrity case was filed in 1987. And just last month, they filed a motion to close the estate, which has not yet been granted. But anyway, what Mr. Hoke did is he had a $10 million claim left to resolve with the receiver. It was dependent upon an application of state law, either New Jersey law or Illinois law. The matter had been litigated by other claimants in his position before, and he had lost. The special master had ruled against him. He took an appeal to the court, and while the appeal was pending, they came across the settlement, $10 million claim, and they got about $4.2 million, a 42% settlement. So at no time during this entire proceeding from day one up until this point in time has Columbia said it was a bad settlement based on the merits. They never sought to intervene under Rule 2018. They never took a 2004 exam, which was open to them, presumably, in the bankruptcy case, to do discovery before there was a motion to settle. They filed not just a response to the motion to settle, but they also filed a surreply to the responses. They never raised any fraud or lack of discretion in the debtor in possession's action in seeking to settle this. And now they come before you and they say, well, gee, we'd like to go discover some fraud. Well, I suppose they would like to hold up the estate, you know, for years and years and years with litigation until we cave to their settlement demands in the state court litigation. That's what this is about. And they weren't shy about saying that. That's exactly what it was about. That's why they focused their pleading on the harm to them, not on the benefit to the estate. And then if you take a look at what they say about their direct pecuniary interest, if you read their briefs, and I'm sure Your Honors have, you will see that not only do they deny any liability at all to C.P. Hall, so I don't know how they could be harmed by the settlement, but every time they talk about any increase in liability, they say, well, it's a possibility, it may be, it's foreseeable, it could be. They never say that as a result of the settlement, we're going to suffer some harm. So even if they had some standing, they had no harm. There was no harm to them that they could demonstrate to the bankruptcy court. So for all of those reasons, Your Honor, I would ask that the court affirm the lower court's decisions. I mean, they just don't have standing. And 1109 is not a substitute for standing, as this court held in James Wilson. That's been settled since 1992. And I don't see any reason in this case for this court to overturn its decisions for the last 20 years about standing in bankruptcy case. If Your Honors don't have any other questions, I'll be happy to cede my time.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Tobin. Mr. Christian?
Thank you. Let me focus first on the point that this appeal is about our standing to appear and be heard. The Ninth Circuit and the Third Circuit sitting en banc have both held in recent...
No, they have all followed our James Wilson case.
Yes, correct.
And in our James Wilson case, we said that everyone with a claim to the race, that is, to the assets of the bankrupt, has a right to be heard before the race is disposed of, since that disposition will extinguish all such claims. But you don't have any interest in the bankruptcy. You're not a creditor.
Except, Your Honor, that if we're going to be asked to indemnify
you're
the same
one
client,
of these people who has a remote... Look, there are all sorts of people who are affected by a bankruptcy who aren't creditors, right? All sorts of people. People
correct.
Who had plans for doing business with the bankrupt. And then it went bankrupt and doesn't do business. Now they can't sell to it and all that. They're not allowed to participate.
Judge Posner, the Supreme Court in Lujan, other courts of appeals, and I think this court have recognized that the kind of injury that's necessary does not have to be a dramatic, immediate one.
No, Lujan is about, Article III standing.
Mm-hmm.
The question here is the limitations that bankruptcy law places on how many indirectly, remotely affected people who are not creditors the bankruptcy. This bankruptcy proceeding is extraordinarily complicated already, and you want to extend it indefinitely while you conduct discovery.
Judge Posner, I see I have a red light.
No,
may
go
I
ahead,
answer
go
your
ahead.
Question? Thank you. Your Honor, first of all, we would not be extending it indefinitely. The case has been going on for years since the time that this proceeding began, dealing with issues that have nothing to do with this dispute. And so we're not dragging anything out here. Secondly, this is not a speculative harm that we're talking about. The settlement that is the subject of a motion by the trustee in this court with the Cooney claimants, who are the ones I mentioned that are the subject of the Cook County action, specifically identifies an arrangement whereby those Cooney claimants would pursue for the benefit of the estate my client, and my client's name specifically in the settlement as a target of those subsequent claims. And so we're not talking about a speculative harm. We're talking about a concrete request that we indemnify the same claims that were the subject of the settlement with the Integrity Estate.
Well, that's the status of being a secondary insurer, obviously, is that you're subject to indemnity claims.
And if the estate is going to argue either that the bankruptcy court...
But now you're saying in every bankruptcy, every secondary insurer, every reinsurer has standing to come in and say, look, we have this potential liability, so we want to be heard.
Well, and the Third Circuit en banc in the Global Industrial Technologies case and the Ninth Circuit in the Thorpe Insulation case both recognize that in a mass tort case where insurance is the only or the most significant asset, that the objecting insurers have standing to appear and be heard under Section 1109B. And those courts based those decisions in part on Your Honor's opinion
well,
in the James
could
Wilson
they
Associates
when
case.
We made so clear that the people who have standing are the creditors. They're the people who have the direct stake in the bankruptcy, and the fact that there are all sorts of eddies. I mean, think of, when General Motors went bankrupt, firms all along the Midwest collapsed, right? Because they were involved in the chain of supply and distribution for automobiles. They weren't all creditors, and they weren't allowed into the bankruptcy.
Judge Posner, I think it's clear that not only creditors are entitled to standing. Under Section 1109B specifically, the list is not limited to standing, and the cases say that the list that's in 1109B is not exhaustive. And so it's clear...
Yes, but there's just a question whether allowing clients like yours in are going to make bankruptcy totally unworkable because of an indefinite number of remotely concerned reinsurers.
I guess, Judge Posner, I reject the premise in this case that our concerns about this particular transaction are remote. There may be, let's say there were another...
Of course they're not remote in the sense that, yes, you have a stake or your client wouldn't be spending all this money.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
But there are a lot of people in that position.
What would be your limiting principle on 1109?
Well, first of all, Judge Flom, I would say that 1109 uses the phrase parties in interest, and I think the
we've kind of got some case law on what a party in interest is.
Correct, and there is case law suggesting that party in interest, as used there, is essentially the same as Article III standing. And I think
no,
that's...
No, 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 it can't be. You cannot equate this to Article III.
Well, the Third Circuit and the Ninth Circuit
have... Because they wouldn't need to have 1109 if they had Article III, right? If they right. said, yeah, you have to understand Article III.
Well, I think, Judge Posner, in the James Wilson Associates case, you described 1109B in terms of being an express statement of what's implicit, and the subsequent cases, including from the Third Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, have built on that.
Well, we said creditors in James Wilson.
And I gather that was the issue in James Wilson. I mean, here we're just presented with different facts. But the point is, this court's sister circuits have recognized, some of them relying on James Wilson Associates, that the question
yeah,
is, are you a party
in
interest?
Opinion. That's the problem.
Well, and
they
I guess...
They don't read the whole paragraph.
To
they
answer,
stopped before creditors,
to,
right?
To answer Judge Flom's question directly, I would... We think the Third Circuit en banc in Global Industrial Technologies and the Ninth Circuit in Thorpe Insulation got it right when they basically equated bankruptcy court party in interest standing under 1109B with Article III
yeah,
standing.
Well, that can't be right. But anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We liked your argument. And we thank Mr. Tobin as well.